which is good. I think it's good to study these chapters closer together, actually, because we'll talk about it in just a moment, but 16 through 19? 16, 17, 18. Yeah, 16 through 19 create a four-chapter section that we'll talk about what it's doing in just a moment. Okay, so we are in Numbers 16 and 17. This is dealing with Korah's rebellion. This is mentioned a couple times in the New Testament. In the book of Jude, it's a place where, in the context of dealing with false teachers who are interested in their own glory and the jealousy of people who have more prominence than they do and stuff like this. So the New Testament brings up this, and we'll kind of walk through this. We won't read everything in it, but we'll highlight things and read a lot of it. But this is the outline chart for Numbers that we've been looking at. The first 10 chapters of the book of Numbers, the Israelites were at Mount Sinai. And in those first 10 chapters, were the Israelites obeying or disobeying God? They were obeying. They did everything God told them to do, organizing the camp in a certain way, get the lepers outside of the camp, count the people, and they counted the people. So in other words, in the first 10 chapters, the Israelites got all of the checkmark commands done. They did all the checkmarkable things. But in chapters 11 through 21, the kinds of sins that they started struggling with were attitude sins, which can really be like my situation, where I know that I go to the right kind of church, it's structured the right way, we worship the right way, I got the checkmarkable things done, but the struggle that I can have is my attitude. And so in chapters 16 and 17, we're going to see the second time in Numbers where there's a complaint about the leadership. So from chapters 11 through 21, we've noted that there's seven complaints that the people make, and they begin and end with something dealing with fire that God does, the fiery serpents. He sends fire around the camp the first time. The second one and the second to the last, they're complaining about food and water. The third and the third to the last, they're complaining about the leadership. The first time it's the leadership of Moses. The second time it's the leadership of Moses and Aaron and really the priesthood. And so there's a parallel structure going on in these chapters, and we're nearing the end of these series of complaints, but we're looking at this third to the last one this morning. Any comments or questions just on this chart here that we've seen a lot of times now? One other thing that we've noted about this is that throughout these complaints, with the exception of the second and the second to the last one, Moses is constantly interceding for the people. And I think one of the things that has struck me a lot as we've been going through the book of Numbers is when I think of needing Jesus' intercession, I think about it oftentimes in terms of, like, you know, really serious sins. But I don't think about it in terms of complaining. But we're learning in this that something that might seem as not such a big deal like complaining is something that the Israelites needed intercession for. And so Jesus ever lives to make intercession for us for things that we might not even realize needed intercession because our culture doesn't really make a big deal out of it or whatever. So here we're going to talk about this complaint that the Israelites have over the leadership of the priesthood and how that's structured. So I mentioned just a moment ago that this begins this short section in Numbers on the priesthood and holy things. So this is probably one of the most sustained, holistic views in the Old Testament of the priesthood and the things pertaining to the priesthood. So chapter 16 and 17, you've got Korah's rebellion, and it's showing who God has chosen to be the priests. Chapter 18 is dealing with the laws for the priests and the Levites, and then chapter 19 is dealing with laws for purification. So if you've ever wondered, like, okay, why is it in these 10 chapters of Numbers, you've got this complaint and then some laws and then another complaint and some laws. You see how this flows from it. They're complaining about the leadership. And then after God establishes once and for all who the leaders are, then he backs it up with more instructions for those leaders. So it all fits the context, although it might seem kind of disjointed in our minds. But that's the flow of thought that's going on in this subsection. Also, the sons of Korah, the descendants of this man named Korah, they later write some of the Psalms. And so they seem to be a good example in the Bible of learning from the mistakes of their ancestors. And so the outline of what we're looking at this morning, 16, 1 through 40, there's going to be the first story, and it's the rebellion of Korah. There's a second story, and the congregation of the people are going to rebel over what happened to Korah's rebellion. And then chapter 17 is going to have Aaron's budded staff. So you've got like three stories within this overall section that we're looking at this morning. Any comments or questions about that before we start looking at the text? All right. And as always, I have the notes up here for afterwards. Everything that you're going to see on the PowerPoint is available here, so don't feel like you need to write everything down that you see on the PowerPoint. And so let's go ahead and get started then with this first story, the rebellion of Korah itself. I'll go ahead and start out with 16:1-3. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, son of Kohath, son of Levi, and Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took men. And they rose up before Moses with a number of the people of Israel, 250 chiefs of the congregation, chosen from the assembly, well-known men. They assembled themselves together against Moses and against Aaron and said to them, "You have gone too far, for all in the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?" Okay, let's start out by thinking, first of all, who are the people that are challenging the leadership here? The first one, his name is Korah. And what tribe is he from? Or what family within Levi is he from? He's from Levi, and then within Levi, which clan? Kohath. Do you remember in Numbers 3 and 4 where it talked about the different duties of the clans within Levi? The Kohathites were supposed to carry what? The holy things, because you remember that, because there's an H in the middle of it. Kohath carries the holy things. Gershom carried the girly things, like the fabrics. And Merari carried the manly things, like the poles and the structure for the tabernacle and stuff like this. And so how cool would that have been to be a Kohathite, where you get to carry the Ark of the Covenant on the poles, and you get to carry the altar of incense? Like, of the clans that get to carry the tabernacle, this is the clan that you would have wanted to be. And even this man in this situation, he's raising himself up with three people who all descend from who? In verse 1. Dathan, Abiram, and On are descendants of who? Reuben. Now, who's Reuben? He was the oldest son of Jacob. In the ancient world, the oldest son traditionally received what? The blessings, greater responsibilities and stuff. So I kind of wonder, you've got Korah from Kohath, and then he gets the tribe that is the firstborn tribe, and maybe he whips them up and says, "Hey, like, isn't that kind of not fair that you guys were the firstborn tribe and you should have greater prominence," or something like that? One thing to point out about Korah and the sons of Reuben, how did they ever partner up to begin with? Do you remember that picture that I've been showing on how the Israelites camped around the tabernacle? Here's a little part of it. I don't have much context on here for you. But this is where the tabernacle was. And so going this direction is east. And remember, Judah would have been camped here. On the south side of the tabernacle, you had Reuben. But then you'd have the Kohathites here on the south side too. Which means that when they were camped, they were like neighboring with each other. And the people that they're closest in proximity to, you can imagine the Kohathites going out to where the camp of the Reubenites are. And they start complaining to them like, "Hey, what is this business going on over here at the tabernacle? And it's not really fair that it's working out the way that it is." And so they kind of stir one another up. And I think it's just worth noting that from that picture that they camped together. Now, On, one of the sons of Reuben, is not going to be mentioned again in this story. I don't know if he drops out of the picture. I don't know if he really wasn't a prominent person stirring this up to begin with. But, okay, so that's the first four people. Korah, Dathan, Abiram, On. And then there's another group of people that join them. How many are there? 250 people, are they just regular dudes, or what do we know about them from this text? They're leaders, they're respected people. People that you would have looked up to for counsel and advice and everything like this. Okay, so imagine you've got 254 people, and they come up to Moses and Aaron, and this is their accusation in verse 3. They say, "You've gone too far." Like, Moses, the problem that we have with you, the stated reason that they have is all the congregation is holy. God called all of us to be holy. So why is it, Moses and Aaron, that you guys have exalted yourselves above all of us? Was all the congregation holy? Were they all supposed to be a holy priesthood? Yeah. Did that mean that they were all supposed to have the same roles? No. And so they're using a partial truth to try to ram down their own initiatives and concern for what we'll talk about in just a moment. But this is their stated reason for their problem. Now, oftentimes there can be a stated reason and then there can be a hidden reason on what's really going on. So I think what's going on here actually is they're just jealous that some of their relatives have higher positions in the nation. Who designed these roles? God did. Blaine, were you going to say something? Yeah, God. Okay, so one thing that we can see immediately from Korah here, and he wasn't content with the role that God gave to him. Can you identify any ways that that could be happening in our society today, specifically with religious matters? Yeah. Is that becoming a more commonly accepted thing that women should be able to... And none of this is against women. God wasn't against the Kohathites. In fact, he had given them great responsibilities. And so this shows you that this isn't dealing with male and female roles, but it shows you the principle that God has always been concerned with roles that are assigned to people. And people have always tried to fight against the roles that God has given people. We'll say more about this as we go through that. But any other comments or thoughts on that? Yeah, Ruth. Or I'm sorry, Janice. Yes. Yes. Good. Good. Right. Good. Jerry? I know. Yeah, it's interesting that the first time there's complaints about leadership, Aaron was one of the ones heading this up, and now he's getting it. So, Sewell? Right. Yeah, couldn't that happen today where like, well, I'm a priest too in the new covenant, so you, Mr. Elder, who do you think you are right now? Or what? Like, we get some of these same kind of attitudes where we're not appreciating the roles God has given the leaders in a church, and then our position to be under those leaders. Trying to buck against that is kind of in some ways like the American way, like rebelling against things, rebelling against authorities in some ways. I don't mean that in any kind of political whatever statement, but I'm just saying that's kind of what a lot of people do here. And so we might kind of share some of those same attitudes as Korah sometimes, and stories like this need to kind of rein us in a little bit. Any other comments about that? Yes, it was. You got these rebellious people that are not submitting to authorities. Korah is a great example of this. Look at in verses 4 through 7, Moses is going to give this proposal, and he's going to offer this experiment. He says, okay, you guys want to be priests? How about this? You guys bring your censers, these like fire pan things, and tomorrow you guys come and you try to offer incense to the Lord, and we'll see if the Lord will accept the sacrifice or the incense that you want to bring. By the way, who was it in the Old Testament that was actually authorized to bring incense before God, and they did it the wrong way and they were incinerated? Nadab and Abihu. And so for Moses to say, all right, you guys think that you can, how about this? Tomorrow you bring your incense. How many of these guys are thinking about Nadab and Abihu? We'll bring this up a couple of times because their fate's going to be similar to Nadab and Abihu's. But notice that in verse 7, Moses says to them, you're the ones who have gone too far. In verse 3, the people that start this rebellion, they tell Moses and Aaron, you guys have gone too far, trying to think that you're above all of us and stuff. And then Moses says, no, you're the ones who have gone too far. Oftentimes, the accusations we make of other people are the very things that are true about ourselves. Psychologists call that projecting. They're projecting out what's actually true about you because you don't want to see it in yourself. Okay, so that's the proposal, and we're going to work towards them actually coming the next day and doing this. But look at starting around verse 8. Moses, in verses 8 through 11, gives them like this little sermon about this situation. Moses said to Korah, "Hear now, you sons of Levi, is it too small a thing that the God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself to do service in the tabernacle of the Lord and to stand before the congregation to minister to them, and that he has brought you near him and all your brothers, the sons of Levi, with you? And would you seek the priesthood also? Therefore, it is against the Lord that you and all your company have gathered together. What is Aaron that you grumble against him?" I love this phrase. Is it too small a thing that you guys already get to be in the tabernacle carrying the holy things? Is that too small to you that you want more power and more influence? Now, and I think about some examples of this today. Is it too small a thing that you're teaching the kids classes? Like you think that it's unimportant that you're helping shape the minds of kids that are going to grow up to be Christians one day and be the next generation of Christians, as people oftentimes say? Is it too small a thing that you're only a deacon? Don't you realize that that helps a lot of the work happen in this church? You see how people can start to fight against some of these. Is it too small a thing that you're raising your kids in the Lord? That you're in this season of life where you might not be able to do all the things within the church that you would like to be doing, but you've got the extremely important role of raising your children to be Christians one day. And so I think in seeing all of this, Moses is trying to help them appreciate the role that they've been given. We have to fight against the danger of being spiritual descendants of Korah, where we start to neglect the roles that have been given to us, and we start looking at what other people can do. The job that we have to do is whatever has been set right in front of us. And Moses is trying to help them see that here. Any comments or questions you guys want to make about that, Blaine? Yes. Right. No. Yeah, very good. And I think you see his meekness there, like what was demonstrated in chapter 12 as well. He's just falling down before God. Right. 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 What is the appeal to having greater position of authority and power? Why is that attractive? Yeah, pride, like I want to be above more people. And we need positions of leadership. I'm not saying everybody that's in one has that kind of heart. But when people are trying to get positions like this in an ungodly way, pride, what else could be at the heart of this? Yeah, the desire to be in control of things. Yeah, the adoration of people, all these different sorts of things. And so do you think that, so in a church like Embry Hills, there's a lot of people doing a lot of good things, right? Could we ever like look at what other people are doing and get frustrated that we're not given more task and more responsibility? And when there's a lot of moving parts working, we got to be careful of having the same kind of attitude that Korah does here. Yeah, Janice. Yeah. Right. Yes. Very good. Cherry? Right. Yeah, I think that's right. That would be part of the problem of not paying attention to the role that you've been assigned, not being jealous over what other people, like, just do what's in front of you. God sees everything that you're doing. Is it too small a thing that you have this thing in front of you to do right now? Just focus on that. So, yeah, very good. Okay, so that's Moses' response to them and the proposal. So we're working towards the next day now where they're going to actually do this. Look at verses 12 through 15, though. And Moses sent to call Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and they said, "We will not come up. Is it a small thing that you have brought us up out of the land of the land flowing with milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness, that you must also make yourself a prince over us? Moreover, you have not brought us out into the land flowing with milk and honey, nor given us an inheritance of fields and vineyards. Will you put out the eyes of these men? We will not come up." And Moses was very angry. The only time the Bible says that Moses was angry. Moses was very angry and said to the Lord, "Do not respect their offering. I have not taken one donkey from them, and I have not harmed one of them." Okay. So I take what's happening here is that Moses has given this little message to them. And then Dathan and Abiram, their answer is, "Yeah, we're not going to come up and talk to you, Moses, right now. We don't want civil dialogue." Well, there's no reason in actually having a conversation about any of these things. So they throw out more accusations. They accuse Moses, "You've made yourself the prince over us. You've exalted yourself above us." By the way, did Moses want to be the leader of the people, or did God have to talk him into it and then rebuke him into it? Moses didn't want the position. And so they're giving more false accusations. And notice what they do with this land flowing with milk and honey business. What do they say is the land flowing with milk and honey? Egypt. Isn't that crazy that prison has now become paradise in their memory? And then, so they say that you've taken us from the land that was flowing with milk and honey, and then you haven't brought us to the land that's flowing with milk and honey. Why haven't they been brought into the land yet? Whose fault was that? Their fault. So you've got these people who can't acknowledge that they might have had something to do with the problem right now. And instead, the only thing they can do is throw accusations at other people. And I think you see in this that when you have worldly ambition, it causes you to be blind to so many things that are obviously true. They're making accusations that aren't true. They're not willing to reason with anybody. They're telling Moses two times in this text, "We're not going to come up and talk to you right now." And so Moses' prayer, he's very angry at this. And he prays that God, when they bring this incense, do not respect it. It's not within your law to respect these people doing this kind of thing. Just don't respect it. It's one of the times where you don't see him pleading for forgiveness. He's going to do that in just a moment. But they're dead set on doing something that they shouldn't do. And so this prayer is appropriate, I believe. Anything you guys want to say through verse 15 here? Yeah. What do you make of that? God, Moses telling God what to do here. I kind of look at this as him expressing himself to God, not thinking he's above him in any way, but that God is okay with us praying really honestly and in a raw way about how we feel. Right. Right. And there's times where that's okay. Not that the person really thinks. Right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Good point. Yes. Right. Right. And has Moses tried to reason with them? He tried to reason with them and they say, we're not going to talk to you about this. OK, then I don't know what else to do. And so this is we're going to see them get incinerated here in just a moment. OK, Danny's working on that. OK, thanks. OK, so verses 16 through 19, the next day it gets ready. They're approaching the tabernacle. The instructions are reiterated that these men are going to bring their censers. So 250 men. Can you imagine this? Like, they've all lined up And they've got like their sense of like, yeah, we're ready. Like, we're going to show all of you once and for all that we do have the rightful position to do these things. And before they're about to make their sacrifice, God's glory comes before the congregation. God's glory does this. God does this in chapter 14. He's going to do it another time in chapter 16. He's going to do it in chapter 20. These moments of great tension, God will overshadow the moment by bringing his glory upon them, so that they can understand who it is that's about to act. Okay, so before God is going to send this judgment, there's a series of instructions. So look at verses, we'll read 20 to 24. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "Separate yourselves from among this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment." And they fell on their faces and said, "O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin, and will you be angry with all the congregation?" And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Say to the congregation, get away from the dwelling of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram." I didn't notice this till recently, but what is God about to do with the whole nation of Israel here? He's about to destroy. This is another time where God is, but this time he doesn't like really have a conversation with Moses beforehand. He's just about to do it. And so God, Moses intercedes. This is another time where he intercedes, and he says, "God, are you going to destroy everybody because of a couple people here? I think there's people. Can somebody get the door over there? I think there's people wanting to get in. I don't recognize any of them actually. Oh, that was Jason? Oh, okay. I know them. Anyways, bad angle. Okay, so where was I? Yeah, so Moses is interceding for the people here. And so what does God tell them to do that indicates he's going to rescue them or he's going to not destroy the whole congregation? Yeah, get away from Dathan, Abiram, and Korah and his people. Just separate yourselves from them, which is indicating that the judgment's going to be just on them. And so they depart from the doomed tents of those people. Verses 28 to 30. Look what Moses says here. This is interesting. So imagine like he's just called for people. OK, guys, if you want to escape this judgment, get away from their tents because their tents are about to be destroyed. So some people kind of shuffle away from it. And the really stubborn people go, "No, we will stay here. We think that they're right." So then with that kind of in your mind, Moses says this in verse 28. Moses said, "Hereby you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works and that it has not been of my own accord. If these men die as all men die, or if they are visited by the fate of all mankind, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord creates something new and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up, with all that belongs to them, and they go down alive into Sheol, then you shall know that these men have despised the Lord." All right, so Moses is saying, all right, these people that are stubborn, they're going to stay here. If these people just die of old age or whatever, then no big deal. But if God does something like really new, like swallowing them up, then that's a clear sign to all of you that this rebellion is not what God wants. And so Moses is the one that kind of brings this up, and guess what God is going to do then? Look at verses 31 to 35. "And as soon as he finished speaking all these words, the ground under them split apart, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up with their households and all the people who belonged to Korah and all their goods. So they and all that belonged to them went down alive into Sheol. And the earth closed over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. And all Israel who were around them fled at their cry, and they said, 'Lest the earth swallow us up.' And fire came out from the Lord and consumed the 250 men offering the incense." Okay, so in this moment, you've got two judgments. The first judgment is on the people that continue to align themselves with Korah. We don't get the number of those people. And so the earth just, as soon as Moses is done speaking, just boom, and they all fall into it. Now, there's a few interesting things, I think, to point out about this. Does this mean that Korah's, like, little kids died, too? Does anybody know the answer to that? Okay. And Moses had also encouraged the people, separate yourself. So did all the kids die? Numbers 26 in the second census, verses 10 and 11, shows you that the kids did not die. So I don't know what this would have looked like if Moses was saying, separate yourselves because there's a judgment coming. And some of the kids are like, the kids, like, get the kids, somebody help them. Or maybe like one of the moms walks away from it and like takes the kids. And then like you got the stubborn husband staying there like, I'm going to stay here and I'm going to go down with the ship, I guess. And so the kids do get spared in this moment. And I think Moses' warnings maybe helped with that. Anything ironic to you about the earth swallowing them up? What do you guys think about that? Yeah, and so the world consumed them. That's a good thought. I never thought about that. I like that. Ruth? I think Moses is kind of like asking God to do something like this, and then God does it. I think God is answering Moses' request here. I think, yeah. Any other things that are like ironic or interesting to you about the earth swallowing them up? Yeah, Blaine? Yes. Yeah, now they're being consumed by it. Another thing, too, with this, what was man supposed to have over the earth? Dominion. And it's ironic that throughout the Bible, sinful man ends up being destroyed by the earth. Of course, God is the one doing it, but he's using the earth to do it. And so these people who don't have dominion over their own jealousy and envy and ego are themselves being consumed by the earth. And this is also kind of like a reverse version of Enoch, because Enoch goes alive up to God. These people go alive down to Sheol. I don't know how long they were alive there until they died. There's a lot of mysterious things about that that I don't know the answer to. So that's the earth swallowing up. And then can you imagine being one of those guys with the censers, and you're like about to give your fire to the Lord, and then you look over and see that. And you're like, oh no, we're making a mistake right now. Teresa, were you going to say something? Right. Right. Yeah, and it's like their tents, like all of their possessions, like none of that is accessible anymore. So it's not like a cavern opening up. It's opening and then closing. Yeah. So very miraculous, obviously. Okay, so then you've got the 250 men. Fire consumes them, just like it may have with Nadab and Abihu. And so that's the rebellion of Korah. It ends in a fiery disaster. Now, we won't read this, but 36 to 40, what they do with the 250 censers is they collect all of them from the fire and they burn it down, and then they create plates, like a new plate to plate the altar of incense with, which is interesting because these guys wanted to have a legacy of being priests, and some of their work got to stay in the tabernacle, just not in the way that they would have wanted it. So God always takes the prideful and he humbles them. Anytime we have worldly ambition, earthly ambition like this, the world will end up swallowing us up. And it's not going to go the way that we thought it would. So that's the first story here with Korah's rebellion. Anything else you guys want to say about this? All right. The second story, the next day, look at verses 41 and 42. But on the next day, all the congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and against Aaron, saying, "You have killed the people of the Lord." And when the congregation had assembled against Moses and against Aaron, they turned toward the tent of meeting, and behold, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord appeared. All right. Another complaint. They say, "Moses and Aaron, you guys killed all these people." Why is that such a crazy thing to say? Yeah. Moses, we didn't know you were so powerful that you could swallow people up by commanding the earth and that you could just send fire out of nowhere. Didn't they see what happened? This complaint comes the very next day after the rebellion of Korah. Like, they got to sleep that night and they had time to think about things. And then they still come back the next day and they say, this is ridiculous. And they're complaining again. Jerry? Yeah, why challenge? Like, you see throughout all this that worldly ambition, if I can use this, like, worldly ambition just misses so many things that should be obvious. I thought I saw another hand. Okay. We have to ask ourselves the question, what am I slow to learn right now? Like, shouldn't this have taught them? Just leave it alone. Like, God has his roles that he's assigned people. There's no sense in fighting against it. Just chill out and do the things that you've been asked to do. Are there things that I'm continually fighting against that I've been given good answers to, that people have helped me understand, but I'm still fighting against those things and not willing to learn? Am I finding myself in the position where whenever I'm talking to people, I end up getting the same piece of advice from this person, from this person, from this, but I'm trying to look for a different answer still? Am I slow to learn the things that I just really need to know? The Israelites were this way. I think we can be the same way. We can go to bed at night, get up the next day, and we have the same kind of complaint because we're not learning from the things that are happening around us. Anything you guys want to say through verse 42? All right, so God's glory comes on the congregation again. God warns Moses and Aaron. He tells them to get away so that God can consume the grumblers. But instead, Moses and Aaron actually fall down and they're about to intercede. So look at verses 46 through 50. Who was older, by the way, Moses or Aaron? Aaron was older. How old was Moses when he died? 120. This is part of the 40 years of, like, Aaron here is at least 83, at least. Look at verses, with that in mind, look at verses 46 to 50. And Moses said to Aaron, take your censer and put fire on it from the altar and lay incense on it and carry it quickly to the congregation and make atonement for them. For wrath has gone out from the Lord. The plague has begun. So Aaron took it, as Moses said, and ran into the midst of the assembly. And behold, the plague had already begun among the people. And he put on the incense and made atonement for the people. And he stood between the dead and the living, and the plague was stopped. Now those who died in the plague were 14,700, besides those who died in the affair of Korah. And Aaron returned to Moses at the entrance of the tent of meeting when the plague was stopped. All right. What does the elderly Aaron do here? Yeah, this is like emergency intercession using a censer. Why is that ironic in the context? And by the way, does God receive his incense offering? And does it stop the plague? Why is that so ironic in this context? Yes, and the incense offered on the next day. We shouldn't say it's ironic. We should say it's aaronic because it's Aaron. That's a bad joke. Sorry. It's proving that they really need this guy to be the one that is the intercessor. And so it's proving to everybody, and they know this by experience now, that these need to be the people holding the censers. And I love this picture. I think it's in verse 48 where it says that Aaron stood between the dead and the living. Such a good picture of Jesus and what he's done for us. That we deserved to die because we're slow to learn the things that we need to learn. We keep grumbling. We keep complaining. But God is consistently giving us intercession with the hope that we would continually grow. And here's Aaron, and I can imagine him looking at 15,000 people that have just dropped dead. And he's looking at these other people, and he's bringing this incense, hoping that these people will be spared. I love Aaron and Moses' attitude here. Love for your enemies, the people who just tried to start a revolt against you. And somehow, some way, you still have the concern for these people to run as an 80, 90, 100-something-year-old person out of your genuine concern for these people that have been revolting against you. What a great example of love from a leader. Any comments, any observations? Yes. And this is a great example of them actually offering intercession for them. Yeah, good, good. And the word atonement, it makes up at one ment. You're made at one again in that, from that moment. Yeah.
There's
Good. Yeah. That sometimes you do need to cut some cancer away, but you're still. Right. Good. Good. Right. Right. Good. Good. Teresa? Right. Right. Yep, very good. So, okay, just to wrap up chapter 16, notice the panoramic view of this chapter. What kind of influence did Korah have here? One man had jealousy in his heart, and then he goes to some people that he camped next to, and he starts to talk, maybe in the corner of a tent somewhere, about how we don't like how the leadership is working and all this kind of stuff, or however that worked. And then those people start going to, well, I know somebody I could talk to. I know somebody I could talk to. And that guy that I just talked to, he knows somebody else. So they get 250 people. And then it becomes a super spreader event, which is now in the dictionary. And 14,700 additional people die. All of this started with one guy not being able to control his contentment. And so there's some warnings, I think, that all of us need from this. Be careful what you're spreading to other people. In the words that you speak, in the things that you post on social media, we got to be careful about, like, what everything that I say is like food for their minds. Am I giving them rotten food, or am I giving them food that's going to cultivate growth in them? What kinds of things am I sharing with people? Another thing with this is be careful what you go along with. Could you imagine being one of the 250 men and, like, you hear about this movement that started? And as you hear about people having these grumblings, it would have been appropriate for one of them to go, you know what, this isn't right. This isn't what God said. But evidently these people went along with it. And then finally, you never can predict where your sin is going to take you. Do you think that Korah thought, you know, at the end of all of this, there's going to be 15,000 people dead? When the Bible says that people who walk in sin are walking in darkness, I think the imagery of that is that when you're walking in darkness, you don't know what's in front of you. When you start down on the path of sin, you do not know where your sin is going to take you. You don't know the future. When you're following God, you do know the future because you know where you're going to be one day. The darkness never can predict what's going to happen in the future, though. And so I see that happening there. Okay, anything else you guys want to say about Korah and his rebellion? All right. So Aaron's budded staff in chapter 17. In light of this second plague that had to happen, Moses gives them instructions, the staff being a symbol of authority. You've got Moses telling them to bring a staff representing each tribe. And then you've got an additional 13th staff, I believe, for Levi. And verse 6 is going to show that Levi's staff is going to be among the other staffs. It's not like at the end. It's in the middle, in the midst of the other ones. And so what they're going to do, they're going to have the second experiment where they bring these staffs before the Ark of the Covenant. This is where the most holy place where the high priest would enter once a year. So this is one of those times in the Bible where you've got a group of people being able to enter this area. And here's the experiment, that whichever one of these staffs buds and puts forth something, there's going to be the name of all the tribes on them. And whatever one it is going to definitively show once and for all who God has chosen to have these roles. Look at verse 5. And the staff of the man whom I choose shall sprout. Thus I will make to cease from me the grumblings of the people of Israel, which they grumble against you. Why is God doing this? What's the purpose of this? And to stop the grumbling. Like, okay, Think about the things God has given the people over the last few chapters to help them obey Him. The tassels for your garments at the end of chapter 15. Do that so you can remember what God has said. The new plating around the altar of incense so that you know who it belongs to. And now this staff that's going to bud, and hopefully after these things, they'll just stop complaining about these things. So look what happens in verses 8 through 11. On the next day, Moses went into the tent of the testimony, and behold, the staff of Aaron for the house of Levi had sprouted and put forth buds and produced blossoms, and it bore ripe almonds. Then Moses brought out all the staffs from before the Lord to all the people of Israel, and they looked, and each man took his staff. And the Lord said to Moses, put back the staff of Aaron before the testimony to be kept as a sign for the rebels, that you may make an end of their grumbling against me, lest they die. Thus did Moses, as the Lord commanded him, so he did. All right. Did you notice all the words that are used to describe what this staff did? It sprouted, it put forth, it produced, it bore. You get the point? Like, this staff that was in the middle of all of them, it's not at the end. Nobody could have, like, switched it around for something else really quickly or whatever. It was right in the midst of all of them. And they look at these 13 staffs, and one of them is just, boom, blossoming. Why do you think this was the sign that God chose? Why is this so appropriate? Right. What else would be appropriate about this being the sign for them? Yeah, what's the role of the priesthood? Is it to help the people live? People who are dead, to help them live before God? Like, this is a very appropriate sign. The blossoms, the almond blossoms, apparently those are the first things to spring up during spring, so it's like the first sign of life. But I think this is an appropriate thing because the priesthood is supposed to be people who give life to people. These sticks are dead, and then they put forth these blossoms. We have a God that takes things that are dead and gives them life, but one of the things that we need to have that happen is a priesthood, and that's what Jesus does for us. He takes people who are dead, gives them life. He was dead, and he came back to life. So this is very appropriate for that, and I like that this text says that they all looked. So somebody would have held up this rod in front of everybody, and they all looked on it, and they all would have known that this means we should stop grumbling. This becomes something that's put in the Ark of the Testimony, along with the manna and one of the Ten Commandments. And so from here on out, they don't seem to complain about this kind of thing. This moment seemed to have actually changed them. Okay. Yeah, Teresa. Right, I think Jeremiah chapter 1 does something similar as well with the almond blossoms and stuff like that. So, and they're white, color of purity, so that might be something to do with it as well. So we got those pictures there. Look at verses 12 and 13. And the people of Israel said to Moses, behold, we perish. We are undone. We are all undone. Everyone who comes near to the tabernacle of the Lord shall die. Are we all to perish? Do you see how they flip in their emotions now? It's like originally they're saying, well, we're all holy. We should all be able to, we should have more of us be able to go to this place. And then they're shown that that's not the case. And they, none of us can go here. And so they're panicking by seeing this staff. They look at it and they start panicking. But this shows, like, their fear now leads into chapters 18 and 19, where you have instructions for the priests on the things that they're supposed to do to help people come into God's presence. So you see the flow of thought here. Like, the laws that are in chapters 18 and 19, they flow from this moment. These are not disjointed things. There's a reason that you have these instructions where they're at. But finally, they have a healthy fear, and they know that if they were to try to come before God on their own, that they would die. That's true of us, unless we have a mediator, and we have that in Jesus. So because of him, we can live. He stands between the dead and the living, and we have life because of him. So, okay, anything else you guys want to say about that? Yeah, King Uzziah, yeah. Yeah, do you remember where it was that he got leprosy when he tried to offer? I think it was incense that he tried to offer, right? Where was it that he got leprosy? He was inside the temple, but where on his body did he get leprosy? On his forehead, right? What did the priests have to say what did the turbans have to say on their forehead when they would go into the tabernacle? Holy to the Lord, and he gets leprosy on his forehead, like it's saying unholy to the Lord, because I've done something that I wasn't supposed to do. God's roles need to be respected. Roles within a church, gender roles within the church and within marriage. And when people are trying to fight against what God's roles are for whoever you might be, this is something that God literally swallowed people up over. So for us to go with cultural movements that say this thing or that thing about men or women or whatever, we really need to be careful that we're not following Korah's rebellion. And there's a lot more that I'm tempted to say about some of that, but I'm not going to right now. Yeah.
So.
Yes. Right. Right. Yep. I can imagine them going to the new plating on the altar of incense and say, oh, yeah, remember that story? And then they look into the Ark of the Covenant or however they would have had access to these things. They're like, you see this staff? I wonder if it like always had like fresh almonds on it that just never decayed or something. I'm not sure what that would have been like. I'm sure it would have been a really cool thing to show somebody who's like initiating himself as a new priest. Like, hey, check this out. By the way, if you ever hear people complaining, there's this really interesting story that happened where God literally did this, and here's the evidence. So, all right, very good. Thanks for your guys' good attention and comments. Next week, Lord willing, we won't do this 2 weeks from now because it's too close to Thanksgiving. So next week, we'll look at Numbers 18 and 19, which, again, flow from everything that we just looked at. So as we conclude here, Blaine, could I ask you to pray for us, please?